Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is once again AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for the Limar Technical Net. This has been going on for 44 years, long before me. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we all sit together and learn from each other and teach each other and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me tonight to do it all over again. I'm out of radio range during the Technical Net. And then you either listen over our internet stream or listen to an audio archive that's available later in the week. Or if you have a technical expertise in something in the news and want to share it with us, or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for TechNet puzzles, or if you see something space or NASA related and want me to kind of poke hole and ask him to take a look at it and give his opinion. You can, of course, directly email him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, as always, I keep a link page up with interesting articles, YouTubes, and what have you that I've read throughout the week and want to share with the rest of you. The way to get to that is to type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page, and it's available 24/7. So, you know, if you have insomnia this Wednesday night, or Thursday morning, you can type it in and read it. We have a chat room available that's been rather quiet. You can get to it by typing in chat.ac2gs.com. And as I mentioned earlier, we have an audio stream on the internet. If you can't raise us on the repeater, you can simply type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you an audio stream. And I always like to remind people that MikeAC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it has archives of the Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of many, many smart people who have moved away or become silent keys over the years. Let me drop her a second. Okay, well, we're going to have a regular session tonight, I hope. We'll ask for questions of a technical nature, and hopefully the first few will be amateur radio related, but we'll entertain anything in the science and technology fields. That should take us to about 10:15. Paul will join us with the SpaceNet report. That should take us to about 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. And a happy Mother's Day to any mothers that might be listening. There aren't that many female amateur radio operators that participate in the Technical Net. I wish that wasn't true, but they're few and far between. But any of them out there that might be listening, I wish you a very enjoyable remainder of Mother's Day. Anyway, let me drop and ask anyone with any questions or comments or topics for discussion to hit that push to talk and give me your first name, your call sign, and what you got planned.
KU2AMZ.
W2BZ, ham radio related.
Very good. Mike recognized, Rich recognized, John recognized. That's very good. Anyone else want to put your name down on the list for tonight? Okay, hopefully as the night progresses, there'll be more inquiries and comments and what have you. Mike, KD2AMZ, what's on your mind for tonight?
KD2AMZ, what I'd like to discuss is definitely ham radio related. Given the events of the past 3 days, as we all know, HF was in a blackout condition, I would like to discuss, for example, like what is an SFI, you know, the solar flare index? What is the A index? What is the K index? All of which are, well, at least HF, are heavily dependent upon those factors. So I'd like to talk our sun, which has been in, let's say, a rambunctious mood for the past few days.
Yes, I've noticed it. My other club has a 10-meter net that I'm usually the net control operator. I wasn't today, but I took a look in, and once again, the farthest excuse for DXing one could have would be Queens. So the geomagnetic storms have been particularly violent the last few days, and they have knocked out most of the band. They've probably been knocking out 10 meters for the most part for a while now. I don't know how many people kind of regularly go up there on 10 meters. You know, when the sunspot cycle was coming up, things were very busy. And then all of a sudden, around last spring, they just died, and they died through the summer, and they woke up a little bit during the fall and winter, and now they sort of died again. So, but the sunspot activity was still active, so it wasn't that the sunspot cycle had prematurely gotten out of steam. In addition to the sunspot activity, which is good for the F1, F2 layer, we suffered a great deal of magnetic storms, which disrupted the F1, F2. So what the sun gives us with one hand takes away with another and causes dysfunction. I don't really, you know, without a card to kind of explain all the minutiae that the sunspot reports actually mean. You know, I kind of just look at sunspot activity, and ultimately, it's, you know, propagation is king. So even if sunspot activity is very high, the index is high, and I go over to 10 meters and I can't hear anyone pass weans, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. If there's anyone out there who's kind of studied up on what the specific numbers for the sunspot activity, the sun activity is, and wants to share it with us, please feel free.
Well, I can give you an article that I had to do some research myself there, Roy.
Yeah, Lou, you want to share something with us?
I love doubling. Is NY2H?
Yes, Lou.
If I may, I took a look at it earlier today, and I have some info.
Sure, please do.
Okay. So, the solar flux index, of course, has to do with the sun's radiation output, sunspot activity. Right now, we're standing at a 222, which is quite good, actually. There should be a guide here. I think anything over 100 is kind of excellent. The K index, has to do with storm activity, and it goes from 0 to 9, 0 being inactive, and then progressively up, very quiet, quiet, unsettled, active, minor storm, major storm, severe, very severe, and extremely severe. Extremely severe would be a 9. Right now we're at a 4, so we're at active. 4 is active. Now the A index, the alpha index, has to do with the magnetic activity, and that's what we're experiencing now. The A currently is 65. And 65 is a major storm. I believe earlier today it was over 100, which is a severe storm. So I guess it's subsiding a little bit. So this is magnetic activity, and it explains why a lot of people were able to look at the Aurora Borealis from some southern locations. Second.
82 AMZ.
Yes, Mike?
Roy was 100% correct. I was about to say, if you go to QST September 2002 article, it explains all the terms. Absolutely correct with the K from 0 to 9, 0 to 400, et cetera, et cetera. It does a great article in there, which explains it quite well. I highly recommend everybody read it. That's September 2002 QST. You know, we can always look it up. But, yeah, it's been rather severe, and it's bands are coming back to life. I was just on 40 meters. Not as good, but it's coming back to life.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Lou. Thanks a lot. I kind of got to get myself a little card and just have it somewhere available, because for some odd reason, the different solar indexes don't really stick in my head for more than about, 30 days, 60 days or something. So I'm going to have to get a little legend someplace in case this ever comes up. But, you know, the problem is that these magnetic storms not only have knocked the lower bands, but, I mean, they keep on pummeling 10 meters. I don't think 10 meters has been decent for about a month now. Okay, I guess we're talked out about solar storms and such. Well, you know, we still supposedly have not reached the peak of solar activity. That should be coming in about 6 months or so, but you never know. You only know when you're on the downslope that you've reached the peak and gone. Any other comments before we move on?
WS21.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, there's a NOAA website that really gives the important numbers, and especially for visual, the K is very important. And the highest it was 9,
and then it would drop down about 5 or so. And then now it's back up to 6 or 6.5 or something. So it's starting to climb up again this evening. I'm just looking at the website now. Hold on. Yeah, if you go to, it's an old website. The most important one for visual and actually for radio communications as well. I like the K index. And it's www.swpc.noaa.gov. You go there and then you scroll up and down and you see the different, a couple of the different indexes. And it's by the hour. I mean, you know, you can see what it was a couple of hours ago. I think it's the last 3 or 4 hours or so are very accurate. Back to you, Ron.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Paul. Yeah, there's a lot of very good information. There's this little gadget that you could get installed in web pages and in Windows regular gadget. And I used to use it every week, but it got very frustrating this springtime because I would look at the gadget and it would tell me about the high sunspot activity, and I wouldn't be able to hear anyone past Queens. So I stopped kind of using it, and I just you know, it's sort of like the importance of a weather report from another city, almost. So I haven't been using it that much these days. I just go by turning on the radio and seeing what kind of activity. And it was rather depressing when I turned it on this morning and just saw the whole pan adapter was flat.
Okay. Yeah, I would imagine. But this is pretty good. Like, you know, like a few hours ago, the numbers were low, like 3... below 4, but now it's starting to get a little darker. The sun's starting to go down, and now the numbers climbed up, like I said, about 6, 6.5. And this website, you scroll down, you'll see a map, you know, the northern part of the globe, and you can see, like, in the daytime, most of the activity, you know, would be like in Russia, you know, and very little in the United States and Canada. But then as it progresses and its day turns to night, it reverses. You can see that it has shifted from Russia to the United States and Canada and hardly anything in Russia. So it's kind of fun to look at that as the day goes by. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I got to check that out. I mean, there's a lot of apps that kind of do where the sun is still shining, where it's dusk, where it's on, where it's night, and you can kind of see the animation as it goes round and round and speed it up, slow it down, or set it for a certain time. So I'll have to check that out.
Okay. Yeah. No app yet. This is just their website, and it's government, so there's no commercials whatsoever, no advertising. No advertisements popping up on your screen. WS2N.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, of course, everyone out there should avail themselves of ad blockers if they can. It makes life much more tolerable. And surprisingly, commercial companies don't seem to be able to get around ad blockers yet. So while you still have that opportunity, you know, we see enough advertisement is my philosophy. Any way we can limit it is a good thing for us. Anyway, thank you, Paul. Any other comments before we move on?
W2BZ. One thing I don't understand, Roy, is you said we're 6 months from a top. I remember in 1991 when we were 6 months from a top, you could work the world on a coat hanger, so to speak. It was just amazing. What's the difference?
Well, most likely the difference is this particular cycle is heavy with geomagnetic storms in addition to just simple sunspot activity. It's the solar flares of the sunspot activity that irradiate the ionosphere and activate it. But the geomagnetic storms sort of rip everything apart. So this particular cycle has had much more geomagnetic storms, I believe, than past ones. But, you know, I mean, if you look up the indexes, the sunspot activity is still increasing over the last, you know, 3-4 months. It's just that the geomagnetic storms have been screwing around with the ionospheric layers in addition.
So have the geomagnetic storms been high in activity for, let's say, the past 6 months or a year?
I don't have the actual numbers, but that was my general understanding of, I think, the ARRL, QSE, did some kind of an article about 6 months ago trying to explain why the sunspot activity is high, but, you know, places like 10 meters are kind of dead a lot of times. And their answer were the geomagnetic storms. I don't think there's no kind of cyclical aspect to geomagnetic storms. They're apparently less predictable than the sunspot activity. So I don't know exactly, you know, which sunspot cycles have had more geomagnetic storms than others. But that's what they tend to give you as an excuse for why the sunspot activity is high, but the propagation conditions are terrible.
Yeah, I just wonder if, like I said, if that activity has been high for the last year or so, because approaching the 11-year high in 1991 was still great propagation, unbelievable propagation. I had a 440 in my car with a screwdriver antenna, and I literally worked the world. And now it's sort of dead. So I guess this geomagnetic activity has been going on for a while, and doesn't look like it's subsiding. Nothing like this weekend, but doesn't look like it's subsiding to the point where it may even be at an 11-year high in 6 months, and we still will have a dead 10 meters.
AC2GS, yeah, that's a possibility. Again, the geomagnetic storms don't correlate with the sunspot activity, so approximately every 11 years there's a hike in sunspot activity. How the geomagnetic storms, if there's any kind of non-chaotic periodicity to it, I don't know. But it's just that, yeah, this entire, like I said before, this past spring and summer were terrible on 10 meters. And the reason that QST article gave was the geomagnetic storms that were rather heavy going through those seasons. So, you know, I hope it got it out of its system already and it'll quiet down and 10 meters can open up a bit, because it's get kind of depressing up there.
WB2BX.
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, I just tuned in. I was wondering what you would say about 10 meters. I was on 10 meters briefly this afternoon, worked a guy in Dominica, and we were barely hearing each other. Obviously, I would think from that part of the world, the signals should be booming normally. Go ahead.
Yeah, I tuned in this morning. I wasn't the net control operator, so I just kind of took a look and a little bit of a listen, and the whole pan adapter was dead except for the club net. There wasn't any DXing going on as far as my antenna could tell me.
Oh, I believe it. I mean, the station I was using, the dipole up 100 feet overlooking the water, which is not a spectacular station, but I'm sure the guy would not have been audible on an apartment antenna. So I believe you.
Yeah, it's been kind of terrible for the last month at least. Pretty much most of my contacts, and I have been net control operator, have been with the metropolitan area. I wasn't even able to get New Jersey. So it's been a bad month or so.
Yeah, I don't think I've worked anything really interesting on 10 meters the last month or so. I've seen early in the morning, I've seen some posts through Hong Kong and some others on FT8 coming through from Asia. But I wasn't decoding. Either wasn't decoding them or wasn't on quite early enough. Conditions certainly have not been great. I think a lot of people are disappointed in this sunspot cycle so far. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree as well. Again, it's not that the sunspot activity is low, because there have been times that, you know, last cycle had a kind of smaller double peak. But it's these damn apparent geomagnetic storms that just kind of mess everything else up.
That's apparently true. I have seen that explanation, that a lot of geomagnetic storms wiping things out, even though the sunspots are kind of high. They've been, apparently the cycle is still on the way up. There are some high peaks, some smaller peaks and valleys. So hopefully in the next couple of months we'll see some true sunspot peak conditions.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we'll see. It's like a weather. You just have to deal with it, whatever the universe gives you. Again, the problem is not particularly sunspot, lack of sunspot activity. It's charging up the F1, F2, but then the geomagnetic storms apparently just rip the structure out of F1 and F2 and leave it an ionized mess in the ionosphere and doesn't really give you a nice, stable medium to have refraction take place.
Apparently it results in some anomalous propagation on the lower frequencies. A couple of weeks ago, I worked a station in Shanghai on 40 meters CW about 3 hours after his sunrise, which is kind of weird. And I think I saw in Pat Cook's report something similar that evening. Guy was reporting that he heard Asian broadcasters at the top of 40 meters a lot later than he would expect to hear them. So, we are, head down to lower frequencies. I think some of the geomagnetic activity causes some strangeness. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the magnetic storms can destabilize D-layer as well, and that could lead to some interesting propagation changes.
Yeah, I just got a confirmation on LLTW for contact with VK9DX on Norfolk Island about April of 2 years ago, April of 2022 on 10-meter phone. It was one of those things where he seemed to be in there for a minute or two and was gone, and I didn't get the confirm, and I thought, oh, forget it. It was probably it was either a slim or I got the call wrong or something. But sure enough, it was a legit contact. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's one of the things that people don't really mention. The unpredictability of this hobby is probably one of the big attractions. You know, if you could depend upon things to be the same day in and day out, week in and week out, you know, people would tire of it rather quickly. So it's the odd little quirks that make this hobby additionally interesting to us.
Apparently people love the geosynchronous transponder that the Emirates put up over Europe and Asia, where they have 100% reliable contacts, I guess about 100% of the time, with no skip zone. So people like that too. I remember experiencing that on field as the high orbit satellite that Oscar 10 about 20 or 30 years ago, and that was kind of interesting. Not quite the same as GeoSync, but close to it when that satellite was at Apogee. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, as a new technology, I'm sure that that has a lot of people interested. But if you reduce all of our hobby to just bouncing off geosynchronous satellites, making it a sure thing, I don't think that would eventually lead to the hobby getting more used. If anything, I think people would kind of tire of the surety of a contact instead of the lightning in a bottle aspect of it.
Maybe. Depends on what people want to do. I mean, it probably appeals more to the rag chewers and the contesters and paper chasers like myself. So it's a kind of, I think it appealed to a different segment of ham radio. Appeal more, as you said, to the new technology people and the makers and builders and stuff. And it's entirely possible the people it appeals to may probably contribute more to the hobby than people like myself who just like to get on and accumulate wallpaper. Go ahead.
Well, it would be interesting to see how it would affect FT8 users. Would the number of FT8 users that remain the same, or would it kind of cannibalize them?
I'm not sure that anybody would really want to use FT8 on a GeoSync satellite, because first of all, I don't know if the proposed satellites would support it. And second of all, it would probably appeal to people using the Reg 2 version of FT8. I forget what they call that. We can get on there and sit there for hours and have a keyboard-to-keyboard conversation. People, that would probably be interesting to people on a geosync bird, but not ordinary, not just sitting there and accumulating contacts on FT8. So go ahead.
AC2GS. Yeah, you're alluding to JS8 call, which is actually just FT8. Some guy took the source code because the source code is open source and added a couple of text fields so that in addition to the usual, you know, signal strength, ID, location, you could have sort of a conversation. I haven't talked to too many people who were into JS8 call. I've kept an eye on it. I don't think it would be great for rag chewing, though, because the symbol rate still is as slow as FT8 is. In order to have the conversation that we've just had in the last, say, 10 minutes, it would take a JS8 call probably an hour and a half, which is, I would kind of get tired of that. So JS8 call is not really for long-term rag chewers, in my humble opinion. They're for people who do like to have a little bit more exchange than your signal strength and your location. I wasn't really alluding to FT8 mode on geosynchronous satellite. I was suggesting that the amount of people looking for paper by going through FT8 might get sent off on geosynchronous satellites in order to accomplish sort of the same thing of expand their wallpaper.
That's possible, but, you know, it's a different skill set, different equipment configuration. The people who are going to be up for putting together a five-and-dime system for geosync satellite are probably going to be different people than those who like playing with a FT8 on an HF set. By five and dime, I mean 5 gigahertz up, 10 gigahertz down. And I think that's the standard for the amateur. I think that's what the Emirates transponder is using. I think that's the official designation for that is AO100. Anyway, but you probably look at what people are saying about that satellite to get an idea of what's going to happen in a couple of years when that kind of capability becomes available over Europe and North America, which I guess it looks like it eventually will, because I can't imagine European and North American TAMs wanting the Emirates to be so far ahead of us on technology. Go ahead.
Well, time will tell. You know, it's impossible to tell what the future will be in technology. You know, before Joe Taylor came out with FT8, I don't think anyone would have generally predicted it. So, you know, there's a lot of things out there that have not even been imagined that no doubt will become very popular when it's available. You know, like all things, it depends on how much it costs to get into the game, how many other people are there, and the rewards of the experience. And I don't know about satellites. You know, Paul knows better than I, but I think we're stuffing the skies with way too many satellites, both low and mid and high orbit. And one of these days, there's going to be a heck of a little billiard show in the sky, and people are going to, I think, rethink the amount of satellites that we need orbiting us.
Yeah, I think it's already happening, because the number of satellites up there is causing any number of problems. Some researchers feel there are enough satellites up there now to cause problems with the ionosphere. I find it hard to believe that even a large number of small satellites can affect Mother Nature that seriously. But some doctoral student and his advisor wrote a paper saying they think it's possible. So there is going to be some rethinking of that on a number of levels, and I think even more so if in, say, the next 2 to 5 years of Starship technology reduces the cost of launch to low Earth orbit by a factor of 10 and something, and possibly up to a factor of 100. But that looks like that's marketing puffery, and reducing the cost by a factor of 100 is not actually what's going to happen. But it's still going to be a great reduction in cost, which is going to leave a lot more people with the capability to put up satellites that there may not be room for. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem, among other things, is there are other entrepreneurs looking to get investment money in Starlink-like situations. So you're going to have, and of course, you know, the more it's perceived as an American product, the more Europe is going to want a European product. Certainly the more China is going to want a Chinese product. And before you know it, everyone and their brother is going to be launching rockets to put up as many satellites as humanly possible. You know, the astronomers are going a little crazy with this all because they're already to the point where they have to subtract the satellite glimmer off of their optics.
Charlie?
Yes, Charlie?
To answer the gentleman's question, right now, as of 20 minutes from now, there'll be 6,000 Starlight satellites.
Yeah, but that's just a beginning in Elon's eyes, although Elon has a furtive imagination about how many of his satellites are going to be up there eventually.
Plus, you got the Chinese, and you got the Russians.
Well, I don't know. I'm not that terribly worried about the Russians. They're kind of busy elsewhere doing other things. So I think most of what they tend to do is talk about things rather than do them. The Chinese are viable. At one point or another, Europe's going to want to have their own, just like GPS and other things. So if anything, there's going to be more satellites up there than there are today.
How many they want? I think 6,000 is enough.
Well, I don't know exact numbers, but I recall Elon, you know, wanting a lot more than that. I don't know how Starlink's coverage is these days. I don't think they publish these types of things because it's a privately held company, so they don't have to. So I don't know what their coverage is. Satellite-linked internet has an inherent problem in that the cost of maintaining a good infrastructure across the globe is incredibly expensive, and the only real customers that you ultimately get are rural customers, which is low-population areas, and that leads to kind of low profit. So other than military missions, it's sort of like the satellite-driven cell phones that were going to make people, investors, you know, billions of dollars, and it ended up being basically a military device.
Okay, I'm going to be listening. I got to get ready for SpaceX tonight.
Okay. Anyway, Frank, thanks as always, and we probably should go to our next question for tonight.
Yeah, by all means, go ahead. I'll just be final on that. Is for those yourself and those who are interested, the Airplane Geeks podcast last Wednesday did an interview with the head of marketing for Iridium Next, I think it is, the current iteration of Iridium, where he differentiates what he's doing from the Starlink, and that he's up on, I think, KU band, he's down in L band, around the same frequency as, same frequency range as our 1.2 gig band, 1296 people, same range as GPS, and a couple of other services. Anyway, he differentiates his service by saying L-band will work where Starlink up on KU-band fails because of moisture and rain and stuff in the atmosphere. That's for the next thing, WB2BX.
Okay. Well, we'll see what the future shows us. As I've always said, we're living in a golden age of technology. Not everything succeeds, though. There's a lot of people who have sent out a lot of press releases about a lot of things that you never hear from again. People are really upset with those two artificial intelligent gadgets that were promoted about 6 months ago that were finally released to the public. There's that pin thing that projects an image to your palm of your hand. The software is half-baked, and then there's the orange little box that talks to you, and its software is half-baked. So sometimes the technology jumps up and surprises us, and sometimes it just falls flat on its face. So thanks again, Frank. Rich, what's your topic for tonight?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody else. I have a very simple question, but the answer may not be so simple. I've been a ham since 1962. That's a long time. And I've been building wire antennas for that amount of time, and usually dipoles. And I never knew the dipole formula is 468 over the frequency equals the length of the dipole. But I never knew what 468 meant or how that was derived. And that is my question, Roy.
Okay, very good, Rich. We've discussed this in the past. There are some things that we know by equations, and there are other things that we know by experimental results. And whether fortunately or unfortunately, the optimum length to cut a center-fed dipole is based purely on experimental results. There are underlying theories, but the underlying theories only give you a very rough approximation because real-world, non-theoretical complications complicate things. So the origin of 468 goes back to, I think, something like 1928. The ARRL did a series of experiments. They cut a bunch of wire antennas and tuned them to the proper length for residents. Then they wrote down the numbers and they tried to figure out a fudge factor. Trying to create an equation based on experimental data is you're trying to create an equation that fits curves. So it's not a fundamental understanding of the underlying principles. It's just you have a bunch of experimental data, and you now would like to create either a curve or an equation that will come as close as possible to a solution. And when they did that, they came out with 468. They published it in the ARRL handbook back then, and it's been promulgated ever since. It usually has a little bit of excess length because the adage has always been it's easier to shorten an antenna than to lengthen an antenna. So there are theoretical reasons that theoretically a center-fed dipole is a standing wave antenna, and you need at least half of a wavelength for a standing wave to be created. That's sort of how resonance works in a center-fed dipole. The trouble is that the velocity of the current through the wire is not the speed of light in a vacuum. And also the edges of center-fed dipoles give you additional capacitance and edge effect. So there's a lot of technology that... One sec, let me write for a sec.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
While I agree with everything you said, that formula is just a basic starting point. And it also depends on the dimensions you're using. For example... At 7 megahertz, we know that's 40 meters. We know a dipole is 20 meters, approximately 66 feet. You divide 468 by 7, you get around 66 feet. So it's really intended as a starting point. It's not the end-all, be-all. Now, keep in mind, if you wanted to do it in metric, because that number gives you in feet. If you want to do it in meters, it changes. So it's based specifically... on you want to take half a wave at the frequency in megahertz and get the answer in feet. And again, it's just the starting point.
Yes, I agree with you entirely, Ed. It's But it does factor in the edge effect and the fact that the current isn't going at the speed of light in a vacuum. And it allows for a little bit of additional length because it's easier to shorten something than it is to lengthen it. It's not a legitimate theoretical equation. It's a kind of a rough approximation factor.
Yeah, but how did they couldn't have just guessed that 468. I mean, did they try 10? Did they try 1,058? They had to have something to go on to get close to the answer. And even though 468 over the frequency just is a starting point, I just don't get how they came up with the starting point.
Point is F equals lambda C. And from there, they derived the AF2B.
Yes, okay, but again, we're moving off of theoretical. This is no longer theoretical. This is creating a factor just based on purely experimental methods. The way they got 468 was not using any of these equations. What they did was they put up center-fed dipoles, and they wrote down their resonant frequencies, and they wrote down their length. And they had a long list, and they made an approximation of what factor you could use to approximate the length of the resonant center-fed dipole.
PDH with a comment?
Sure.
I think somebody mentioned it already, but if you start with F lambda equal to C, lambda over 2 equal C over 2F, plug in C at 3 times 10 to the 8th, divide by the frequency of megahertz, you get 1.5 times 10 to the second, or 150. If you convert 150 meters to feet times 3.28 feet per meter, you end up with 492 over the frequency in megahertz. There's the rough starting point. From there, you can jiggle it around a little bit to get the exact thing, which includes edge effects, which includes the velocity factor and stuff like that there.
Okay, but historically my understanding is they didn't sit there with a bunch of slide rules. Again, this 468 came about through experimental findings, and then they reverse engineered it to what factor worked best for people with a little bit of additional length to adjust for any kind of variation. So it wasn't that there were a bunch of people with slide rules who then added the edge effect and added the difference of velocity factor of the antenna. In the case of at least what I was led to believe is the ARRL actually did experiments, got results, and plotted the factor according to the experimentally found results.
Sure, but they had to start somewhere. I mean, they couldn't start at a million and work their way up or down. It gives you a starting point.
Yeah, it gives you a starting point because, once again, what we're dealing with is a standing wave antenna that requires a standing wave. The shortest standing wave you can get out of a center-fed dipole is half of a wavelength. So, and there are equations of that on the Internet. But what they decided that they wanted to do, rather than use that very rough approximation, they wanted to see if they could improve upon that experimentally. And that, as far as I understand, that they did. The 468 is not based on any further theoretical equation. It's just based on that they took approximately half wavelength bit of wire and then tuned it to resonance and then wrote down the numbers and just figured out what the best fudge factor would be.
I didn't hear what station that was that gave the formula with the lambda, which is above my pay grade, but it just said, which is my thinking, they had to start somewhere, and it seems like they started at 490 something over the frequency and then derived 468. Is that true?
VDH with a comment.
Yes, VDH.
If you work out with C, starting with F lambda equals C, which is true for any electromagnetic wave in free space, C being 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second, if you go through all of that and plug in for megahertz, you come out around 492 over the frequency in megahertz is a half wave. Now, from there, then you can trim it down to account for edge effects for velocity factor. But like you say, you need some starting point. You can't just try every number and work up to it. But it gives you a rough starting point from converting from meters per second into feet, which is puts you in the 470, 480, 490 range. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you have to understand, this happened, I think, something like 1929. People had a good approximation already for years and years and years. And one of the reasons why, to this day, we talk very often about 20 meters and 40 meters and 80 meters is because way, way back in the bad old days of those plasma transmitters that just had spewed harmonics, there was no real... initially, after a while, they had tuned networks, but a lot of times, the very, very earliest of radio transmitters, their primary tuned network was the antenna that kind of tuned it for what it was resonant at. That harmonic got through and the others didn't. So it was kind of bandwidth came probably before frequency to many very, very early hams on, you know, using those spark app transmitters.
Roy, I doubled with you. Let me see if I have it. Okay, what I said was that formula got them to 490, and then the ARL, that's the starting point. Then the ARL tweaked that down to 468. But as the gentleman said, and again, I didn't hear his call or his name, you had to start somewhere. You couldn't choose a million and start there, or 10 and start there. They had to start somewhere, and that formula that he gave equaled 490. I think that's the answer, Roy.
Again, it's not like they had that 490 for a long time because those were the equations of electrodynamics. The problem was that real life antennas didn't model perfectly electrodynamics. So the people knew the rough estimate that if you wanted a center fed dipole, you went for the length that was half of a bandwidth of the frequency that you were interested in. So that was sort of a kind of a given from the get go. What happened in 1929 is people wanted to know if there was a better approximation where you didn't have to, decrease the length or increase the length, a severe case. So they were looking for an equation, and since there was no good theoretical equation that would work, they did experimental data, and then they reverse-engineered an equation based on the experimental method. They already know the approximation, but they wanted a closer approximation. And this number that they derived from experimental methods back in 1929 became the de facto factor that a lot of hams use to start off a center-fed dipole length.
So is this 468 just a ham radio thing? If the military were going to build a dipole, would they not use 468?
I don't know. If anyone who came from the Signal Corps knows, if it's in the manuals, please. I'm sure it got generally shared with any and everyone interested in radio theory. So it's probably well known among signal techs and such. Okay, Doug. Okay, John KD2BD, who listens to us and lives in the chat room sometimes, had his, he said 492 divided by frequency equals half wave in free space. 468 over divided by frequency is half wave in a conductor. In other words, the 468 takes into account the approximate velocity factor of a thin conductor. And that's true. It also takes into effect the edge effect. But again, it doesn't do it on the basis of a equation that derived the correction factor. Again, the origin of the number 468, as far as I'm aware, is based on experimental results, and then it's reverse engineered into an equation that approximates what's going on.
WP2E80.
Yes, Ed.
You want an answer for commercial and military aircraft at HF?
Okay.
Commercial and military aircraft use an antenna determined solely and specifically by the size of the airframe, and they use antenna tuners to tune over a wide frequency range. And so they don't really care about these formulas. The London antenna is what it is, and it is your problem to tune it at whatever frequency you want. And the original auto-tuners were very, very, very expensive stuff that was built for the military.
Okay, thank you. I'm sure, though, there is some military spec for a center-fed dipole. I'm sure they have specs for every single thing that they ever promulgated. So I'm sure there's some book with a military specification for how to derive the length of the individual dipoles for a specifically center-fed dipole antenna design.
Hello.
Sorry, I stepped on you. Say again, please.
It is an end fed that is fed right above the radio, and it goes to the top of the tail. Period.
Okay, I understand entirely, Ed. Let me make sure I'm not doubling. Okay, I'm not doubling, hopefully. Anyway, I understand that. I'm just saying that there must be in the signal core manuals some entry for a center-fed dipole someplace.
Yeah, stuff like that, if you're setting up a dipole out in the field, it's the same stuff as HAMS.
I'm just curious if they present the same 468 or whether they have a different way of describing it.
Again, they use very broadband, so they have to use antenna tuners. They're probably operating over 50% bandwidth.
In all cases?
What I'm saying is, they will operate to pick a number from 5 to 10 megahertz with the same antenna, and the antenna tuner has to compensate over that range.
Okay.
Comment.
Yes?
K2GJE, I was in the signal core, over.
Ah, excellent. Let's hear your experiences. Are there military specs for center-fed dipoles?
They gave the ARRL antenna handbook, believe it or not. And most of the time we had like 7-foot whips with some beautiful antenna tuners over.
Ah, okay, very good. There's always been, I think, a tight connection between the ARRL and the signal core. When I was a kid in the 60s, I used to get to the QSC, and they had a lot of military articles.
Bumper mount vertical antennas have always been 7-8 feet. Any more than that, you get into trouble with hitting overhead stuff.
Makes sense.
K2GJE.
Yes?
I only had one installation where we did have a dipole. That was because the transmitter was in a building, and we had this dipole that had jumpers that you could either jump sections or take out sections and adjust it to what you needed over.
Ah, that a nice feature. Okay, so I think we kind of beat this poor horse up. Rich, I don't know what to tell you, because I've kind of rephrased the same thing about 5 different ways. Like I said, people certainly had a starting point. It wasn't like in 1929, no one had the faintest idea how long a center-fed dipole should be. Different people probably had different fudge factors that they preferred, and the ARRL decided to be the, Moses coming off the mountaintop with the best, factoring number to get it done. So that's why it's 468. They could have just as easily have written 469 or 467, and it would be approximately very, very close to that, and people would just go with it. But, for whatever reason, they came up with the 468 from their experimental result, and the rest is history.
Again, but I think they started with 490 is what I got tonight with that C equals lambda formula. That equaled 490, and I think that's where they started, Roy. And then they did what you said. They experimented, and they came up with 468. But I think they started with 490. At least that's what I heard tonight.
Well, I can't tell you, Rich. I wasn't back there in 1929. I am willing to bet that there were other guys with other factors other than 490. 490 is the theoretical basis for finding what the resonant frequency is, but I'm sure long before 1929, people realized that if you plugged in 490, you didn't get a very close number. So I'm sure other people had their own fudge factors. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know, because that isn't part of the story that I read about how the ARRL came up with 468. Any other comments, or we'll move on to the next person?
WB2BXO.
Yes, Frank.
2 points. First of all, I think what we're saying is both versions are true. It sounds like 192 over frequency in megahertz was the theoretical determination initially. It was found not to work, so 468 was determined experimentally. And then somebody worked backwards to the theory to see, okay, why does this 468 work and not 492? And calculated that the proposed that due to skin effect and velocity factor, this is the theoretical reason it works. My other comment is that, as I understand it, one of the modes, HF modes, that the military uses now is, in fact, very wide-banded. I don't remember the exact term. I keep thinking of automatic frequency control, but I know that's not the right term. Where the two radios handshake. It's a broad, a thread spectrum type technique on HF. And I know there were reports of the Air Force using it during the Afghanistan rescue operation because the automatic frequency thing just kind of set itself down in the middle of 20-meter bands, and I think some people were more than a little annoyed by that. So they do, in fact, in military applications, as I understand it, use very broad frequency ranges in a very short period, changing frequency very rapidly, even on HF. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's a bunch of things. You're talking spread spectrum. I think a long time ago, the military really got into traveling wave antennas. Traveling wave antennas don't need to be resonant. And so, although they're not as efficient, for the most part, as standing wave antennas, they have a very broad frequency range.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think my dad learned the traveling wave antennas in Signal Corps and tried to set up a ZEP antenna, off-center fed dipole, so that I could get on 80 meters at our location in Canarsie, where we did not have have the space. We were in one of the row houses in Canarsie. It did work, but it was we needed a huge tuner to tune the thing. And it also tuned into everybody's stereo, so it was kind of a problem to use except very late at night. But, yeah, I think you're right, because that's where my dad learned traveling wave antennas during World War II.
Yeah, about a year or so ago, we were chatting about folded dipoles, and you can sort of tell traveling wave antennas have loading resistors at the edge of them. The better engineered ones usually don't require a lot of wattage because most of the energy is dissipated in RF before it gets to the loading terminal load resistor. But you know, the military have kind of fallen in love with traveling wave antennas simply because they don't have to screw around with antenna tuners and change impedances. They just run it down a very, very, very long wire, and it irradiates for the most part before it ever reaches the resistor.
Yeah, and for the most part, excluding cases of jamming from adversaries, they're working on a clear frequency and don't have you know, some of the challenges amateurs have, though obviously they have plenty of others, you know. Or as my dad used to say, if you can hear each other, pass your traffic. Never mind how strong or weak you are, good.
Yeah, I often re-bring up, I'm sure some people get tired of it, Heavy Lamar, I believe, is on the patent for these transmissions that jump across a band to kind of lessen the chance of being listened in. So hopping spectrum technology, we all have to thank Hedy Lamarr, the actress, for.
Yeah, some of her detractors claim she stole the idea from her husband, who was a Nazi engineer. But the consensus seems to be that she was, in fact, a very bright and intuitive experimenter who figured out a lot of this stuff. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk. I don't remember that she was married to a Nazi engineer, though. I remember there was some industrialist that she was married to. It could be the same guy, different way of describing the same guy. Yes, Ed.
The story, as I heard it, I assume, I forget her name, but it's obvious who you're talking about. She was married to a German industrialist who would often have a batch of people over and they'd have some knockdowns, radio, technical conversations, and they just figured she was a blithering idiot and they could say whatever they wanted in front of her and didn't appreciate she knew exactly what they were talking about. And later, when she came to the United States, she worked with some other people on some ideas she had developed based on what she had learned. And they tried proposing what later became known as frequency hop. And the military showed no interest. But since then, a lot of people are saying the reason the military